From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with John Whitbeck, the former chairman of the Virginia Republican Party. And after that, we'll be talking with Mark Elrich, who is the Montgomery County executive-elect. But joining us now by phone is Jennifer Wexton, U.S. Congressperson-elect. She won the race in District 10 in Virginia. Jennifer Wexton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kojo, and happy anniversary.
Thank you very much, and congratulations to you on your victory. President Trump inserted himself into the midterm, saying, quoting here, "This is also a referendum about me." And indeed, your campaign sought to tie your opponent to Trump. Now you're heading to Congress. You've got to be able to get things done. How do you plan to approach dealing with the president?
Well, I have been working in the minority in the state Senate my entire time there, and that hasn't stopped me from delivering results for my constituents. I would try to work with the president on the issues that we could work together on, you know, things like healthcare, things like infrastructure, and hopefully now with a better balance in Congress, we'll be able to actually get some bipartisan solutions.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
Ms. Wexton, congratulations to you. Let's get to the hardcore issues right away. Will you vote for Nancy Pelosi to be the Speaker of the House?
I have not yet decided who I'm going to vote for Speaker. You know, after 20 months of giving everybody my elevator speech about why they should support me, I look forward to being on the receiving end of some elevator speeches about why I should support any particular leader for Speaker.
And I also want to ask you what kind of committees you are be looking to be on, which, of course, will be influenced by who the Speaker is. But I got to ask you, as a District of Columbia resident citizen, I've gotten any number of tweets and messages from people saying, are you going to support statehood for the District of Columbia?
Absolutely, yes. The fact that D.C. residents, you know, pay taxes and don't get any representation is absurd, and I think that we should make sure that they get voting representation.
Kojo, I ask you your plans to work with or against or for President Trump, if you might agree with him or disagree, but do you have a sense of which, based on your background, what committees you will want to be on since that you will be in the majority? That's a very important decision to make.
Well, one of the committees I've been eyeing is transportation and infrastructure. That is so important to my district. Dulles Airport is in my district. The Silver Line is coming into Loudoun County. And I-81 in the western part of the district really needs some help.
Joining us in studio is Robert McCartney, senior regional correspondent and associate editor for The Washington Post, who I'm sure has a question or two for you, Congresswoman-elect.
Hi, Congresswoman-elect. Congratulations on your victory.
Thank you so much.
The one question that's arisen is there's already a lot of talk about doing a lot of very aggressive investigations, you know, papering the White House with subpoenas and really going after President Trump and the administration in general, as a lot of people in the Democratic base want. But isn't there a risk of a backlash over that the Democrats could basically be seen as more interested in being negative than positive? And we saw there was some backlash over the Kavanaugh hearings. Isn't there a risk that could happen with the Democrats again?
That is certainly a risk. And, you know, I ran on a promise, as did many of my new future colleagues, ran on promises to deliver solutions for Americans on kitchen table issues, on issues that directly impact their lives, things like health care, gun violence prevention, infrastructure, and I think that's where our focus needs to be. That being said, people deserve to know what their government is doing, and so it's completely appropriate that there be oversight, but that should follow the regular order and go through the committee process.
You were one of three Democratic women who defeated Republican incumbents in Virginia congressional races on Tuesday, and indeed, women candidates across the country did well in this election. Do you think the influx of women into Congress will change that body in any significant ways?
Well, we'll have to wait and see. I know that getting 11 new women elected to the 11 new Democratic women elected to the House of Delegates in Virginia last year made a huge difference in how we were able to proceed and the things that we were able to do. You know, after years of fighting, we finally were able to expand Medicaid in Virginia, and we wouldn't have been able to do that without those new women and those new Democrats.
How much did President Trump unpopularity in Virginia? I always have to remind people, even in 2016, when he was running for president, that Trump was not very popular. He was way behind Mark Rubio and other candidates, Ted Cruz. David Ramadan, a former member of the legislature, he said that Barbara Comstock was a perfectly fine congresswoman. He said the fault is the moron in the White House.
Well, I think that there are some other differences that between Barbara Comstock and myself weighed into the my victory. You know, things like gun violence prevention. She was bought and paid for by the gun lobby, and that's an issue that's taken on new importance. The fact that she voted multiple times to repeal the Affordable Care Act and seems to have no interest in finding solutions in that area. So Donald Trump was certainly a factor. And one of the things one of the effects that he had on this election is that people realize they can't just sit on the sidelines and assume everything's going to be okay. So I'm sure that some of the turnout had to do with that. But ultimately, you know, all politics is local, and it had to do with a lot of the issues and the contrast between Barbara Comstock and myself.
Here's Robert McCartney.
Yeah. Another question is, you say you want to put forward a positive agenda and really prove to the American people that you can get things done. But how much can you really get done when we now have divided government again? The Senate is not only in Republican hands, but they've actually increased their majority. The White House obviously is in Republican hands. I mean, aren't we just going to see 2 years of gridlock here?
Well, you know, the people elected us to do something, and the people elected us to go to Washington and work together to find solutions. That's what this past election says to me. And I would hope that our colleagues in the Senate would feel the same way. Historically, the Senate were supposed to be the adults in the room, and I would hope that there will be a return to that sort of ethos in the next Congress.
Here now is Muhammad in Sterling. Muhammad, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. This is Mohammed. My question is about how Shiblan. By the way, I am a voter, and I am one of those that vote for you.
Thank you.
I'm asking, how do you plan to work with the president in terms of the immigration issues that he is so much pissed off?
Your views on immigration and what you plan to do about that in the House of Representatives?
Well, the country needs comprehensive immigration reform. And we, you know, the Gang of Eight in the Senate was able to pass that years ago, and then it just died in the House. I would love to see comprehensive immigration reform. One of the things that is very concerning to me, given the nature of my district, is the attacks on legal immigration. You know, we have a lot of folks who come over on tech visas and you know, have been very beneficial to our growth and development here in Northern Virginia. And to see the cutting of those is very concerning. Same thing with, you know, agricultural visas for the folks in the West who need help harvesting their crops. So I think I would love to see comprehensive immigration reform. If it's not going to be possible, then we need to see where we can find agreement and work on those issues.
Here's Tom Sherwood.
You represented in the state Senate parts are mostly Loudoun County. The western parts of your district go all the way out into Winchester, where Barbara Comstock did better. What would you say to those constituents? How will you try to reach them so they'll feel part of your 10th district?
Well, first, by being there and by going there. And, you know, it actually goes beyond Winchester out through all of Frederick County. So
I can't see that far away.
and, you know, working to find solutions. I-81 is a big issue for them. That is a necessary artery, you know, to move goods from the inland port, to move people to and from. and it needs a lot of work. So there's a lot of work that can be done in that area. Also, there's been a whole lot of business development in the Frederick County, Winchester area. So making sure that they have things like rural broadband, you know, that there is appropriate career and technical training for kids to get what they need from their high school and junior college or college education, and that people have opportunities in all parts of the district, not just in the Eastern Fringe.
I know you don't have a great deal of time left, so give us a signal when you're being dragged away from the phone at this point. But we got a comment on our Facebook page from Jessica, who said, my husband and I took turns driving to District 10 in Virginia to canvass for you over the past few months. In total, we went out 8 times. I cajoled a bunch of mom friends to come out to, and others entertained our 2 small children. We are D.C. residents, and we did this without knowing what your position is on D.C. statehood. So I guess I'm repeating a question that Tom Sherwood asked. But Jessica says, if you support D.C. statehood, how will you move the issue forward in Congress?
I'm going to be going to freshman orientation starting next week, and we'll learn about the actual parliamentary process. But I think that hopefully this is something I can work with our friends in the delegation. Eleanor Holmes Norton, right, and the rest of the D.C. Metro delegation to move that forward.
Ms. Norton's busy getting people to sign on to it. They know it's a long haul to get to statehood, but they do want more visibility to it. So I'm sure she'll welcome you at any moment.
I anticipate she'll be paying me a visit very soon.
Yeah, I was about to say, you already said the 3 magic words, Eleanor Holmes and Norton. Here finally is Robert McCartney.
Yeah, you've mentioned I-81 a couple of times. I know that is an issue of great interest to a lot of your constituents. One of the proposals that's out there is to widen I-81, but then start charging tolls, at least for the new lanes. Is that something that you'd support?
I think that people are told enough already, and obviously, you know, that's something that that my opponent attempted to attack me on without any merit, but. But I think we need to do the hard work to see what we can do without having to toll people for new capacity.
Does that mean you'd support an increase in the gasoline tax to pay for that?
I want to see what all the options are to make it happen.
Jennifer Wexton is the U.S. Congressperson-elect representing District 10 in Virginia. She is currently a Virginia State Senator representing District 33. She's a Democrat. Congresswoman-elect Wexton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Politics Hour. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Mark Elrich, who is the Montgomery County Executive Elect. Next up is John Whitbeck, former chairman of the Virginia Republican Party. John Whitbeck, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, as always.
Well, you just heard us talking with Jennifer Wexton. What did you make of the results in District 10 on Tuesday? Were you surprised by it?
Shocked. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were expecting it to be a close race. We thought it was a toss-up going into it. I thought Barbara was going to win. And I think it means I'm going to get out of the prediction business from now on, I guess.
Well, you got out of being the state party chairman back in the summer, shortly after Corey Stewart got in. His election results were pretty much what people thought they would be, terrible. But sticking with the 10th district, you said that it's clear, you were quoted in one of the news reports, it's clear in Virginia the blue wave is still around. Republicans have to better figure out how we're going to respond. You're no longer the party chairman, but what do you need to do, and what do you think the party will do?
Well, I think our comeback really starts at the local level. I think that there's a opportunity in 2019 for our candidates across the Commonwealth to win some seats back. And we're talking about the important seats like Board of Supervisors, Sheriff, Constitutional Officers, and I think that's really what's going to be the comeback. Local issues, hyper-local issues, land use, transportation, education, hammering home school safety, all the things that we, you know, keeping our property tax rates low, and then see where we are. We're also going to have a major battle in the House of Delegates and the Senate in Virginia, and each house is hanging by one vote. So, you know, it's going to come down to 2 or 3 seats, and boy, it's going to be hard fought. And, it makes me a little more nervous than I would have been Now that Barbara is not going to be there, but we've got some good candidates, and I hope that we can hold.
Here's Robert McCartney of The Washington Post.
Hi, Mr. Whitbeck. You listed a whole bunch of issues there and didn't mention the biggest elephant in the room, which is Mr. Trump. The Trump brand is extremely bad in Virginia. We saw that in all of the races there. You can talk about local issues, but what about the president? Shouldn't you be following the same pattern that Governor Hogan has followed across the river by separating himself from Trump and basically winning over people that way, winning over the moderates you would need to revive the Republican Party in Virginia?
I've always taken it's a fair question considering what we just saw, but you know what I've always said is Washington, D.C. disproportionately impacts our politics, and elections are the aggregate of many things. I don't think you can say it's just one issue, just Trump. I think there's a lot of things that were contributing to it. You know, Scott Taylor, for example, said, you know, one of the things that cost him the election is the top of the ticket got blown out. I think that certainly had an impact. I think, you know, in the 7th district, you know, Dave Bratt's election, that had an impact. The top of the ticket had an impact on it. I think the fact that Tim Kaine had millions and millions of dollars to spend. I mean, we were looking at some of the metrics of the race and just looking at, you know, what they were spending it on. And they had a joint fundraising agreement with the Democratic Party of Virginia that funneled over $3 million into just get out the vote efforts. We had nowhere near that to compete with it. And it's just, they have done a great job. And Susan Zwicker, the I know who's been on your show, is a classy lady. I've always gone along great with her. She's done a great job getting that party ready to go to get out the vote, and it's shown in the last two elections.
You mentioned the top of the ticket without ever mentioning the name of the Republican candidate in the top of the ticket, and that was, of course, Corey Stewart. You stepped down from your chairmanship of the Virginia GOP not long after Corey Stewart won the Republican nomination to take on Tim Kaine for the U.S. Senate. Do you think Corey Stewart's message is somehow, you seem to imply that, hurting the GOP in Virginia?
Yes. I mean, I think a message that runs on Confederate statues and things that are, you know, attacking other Republicans. I mean, standing in front of the General Assembly and all those things. I mean, that doesn't your colleague there, you know, read a quote for me. There was another quote that I gave and I'll repeat it here. And that is, you know, when you attack your own party, And you break down the unity that's essential to winning elections. You know, there are donors that don't want to give. There are volunteers that don't want to volunteer. There's enthusiasm that goes away. And, you know, we have not had the unity that we've needed for the last two cycles to compete in a blue wave. Yep. And it really hurt. And I think that the biggest criticism I have of the Stewart campaign is they never reconciled with the party and really expected everybody to just be there for them. And it's hard to do that. And I really wanted to see them try to unify the party. And unfortunately, it didn't happen.
In a shorter version of that, I'll say it because y'all know you can't say it. Corey Stewart's campaign was a mess. But this is Tom Sherwood. I want to ask about you looking forward. You know, you stepped down as the party chair. You said you want to be part of the solution in the Commonwealth. Do you live in Jennifer Wexton's, I think, 33rd district, Senate district?
I do, yeah. I live in the 33rd.
Something you might seek? She's leaving that. Would you be interested in running for that seat? Or are you looking more broadly? Assuming you're going to run for something. What is it going to be?
I will not be a candidate for the 33rd Senate district. Right now there's about four or five candidates. I'm heavily involved in that process. We have legislative districts that are chaired. I'm helping the legislative district committee put together the nominating process when that happens, because obviously I have a lot of experience with that stuff. But no, I'm not a candidate for the 33rd or anything else at this point.
Well, you know, reporters always look to the next election. I could see you, you know, working for the next 2 years and potentially running against the Ms. Wexton in 2 years. Are you looking that far ahead?
I am not. You know, it's impossible right now in this climate to make any decisions, you know, because everything changes. I mean, you know, it's like we don't know whether the turnout will be like it was in 16, 17, or 18 or something different. I mean, I heard a stat that the 2018 midterm turnout was more than 2012 presidential election. That's incredible. Jennifer Wexton got more votes in the 10th district than Hillary Clinton. I mean, think about that. So we just don't know enough about the district. Is this the new 10th district? Is my home county of Loudoun, is it a 20-point Democrat district like it was on Tuesday? Or does it go back to being a purple, district that swings back and forth like it's always done, or purple county that swings back and forth? We just don't know. We're going to have to wait and see.
Before you go, let's talk about the General Assembly a little bit more again. On Wednesday, Senator Tim Kaine refused to say that Virginia is turning Democrat. What he said, quoting here, is it's still a battleground trending blue. And indeed, there are still slim Republican majorities in both houses of the Virginia General Assembly. But what do you expect from the state house elections in Virginia next year in light of Tuesday's results?
Well, I keep telling our people that, we have to be able to win elections in big turnout. This sort of notion that Republicans, we really need small turnout. Not only is that a bad message that we can only win when nobody votes, but also, we're just not going to compete if this is the new reality. And, the General Assembly elections are going to be a good test of that. I personally believe that campaigns have gotten so much better at data, so much better at get out the vote, so much better at messaging, that high turnout is going to be the future. I may be wrong about that, but I think that's probably what we're likely to see, or at least turnout that's greater than it's been traditionally. And Republicans have to be able to respond to that. And we clearly didn't learn that lesson in the last two elections. Although Barbara Comstock, I will say, planned for an election that was going to be closer to 2016 than 2014, to her credit. It obviously didn't work out. But she did get, I think she got 157,000 votes. In any other midterm, that's a huge advantage for her. And I mean, compared to 2014, just four years earlier, she greatly improved on her midterm total. But, the Wexton campaign just did that much better, and it was an incredible blue wave yet again.
John Whitbeck, former chairman of the Virginia Republican Party, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you all. Thank you very much.
Still to come, Mark Elrich, Montgomery County Executive-elect. He's currently a member of the Montgomery County Council. We got a tweet from somebody named Eleanor Holmes Norton, who said, "Thank you, Congresswoman-elect Jennifer Wexton, for already committing to support D.C. statehood. I look forward to adding you as an original co-sponsor next Congress and having your support as we push for a House floor vote." So Jennifer Wexton's work has already begun in this situation. Before we get out of Virginia, Robert McCartney, talk a little bit. What do we know? What's the latest we know about the possibility of half of Amazon HQ2 coming to Crystal City?
Well, it certainly looks like Crystal City in Arlington, in Northern Virginia, is going to get at least half, conceivably all, of the up to 50,000 jobs that Amazon's going to put in this new second headquarters. We're waiting, on the edge of our seats, basically, to hear what Amazon's going to do. I think there's a pretty good chance the announcement could be next week. I definitely think it'll be before the end of the month. The latest seems to be that it's likely that it will be split. I think, it's possible Crystal City wouldn't get half of it, but I think Crystal City will get at least half, and we're not sure where the other half would be. The New York Times has reported that the other half is going to be in New York City.
In Queens.
In Queens, a Long Island city right across the East River from Midtown Manhattan. I don't know if that's true. Dallas has also been mentioned. It's conceivable that it could be split between New York and Dallas, and Crystal City would be left out in the cold. But we do know, as we reported, the Post reported last Saturday, that Amazon has been in advanced talks about the Crystal City site, and I think it's got a good shot.
You, Robert, and Jonathan O'Connell, I think your colleague broke the story, and it's been played in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and other places, but no one has gone farther than you guys. They've talked, except for the part about Queens. Jeff Bezos said at the Economic Club that he would look at all the data that's necessary, then he would basically make a gut decision. So that's why you're uncertain about what's going to happen, that he could just, whatever the points are, he could change his mind? Or make up his mind differently.
Presumably, first of all, I should say I work for a newspaper that Jeff Bezos owns, but that, you know, he's played no role.
There's no pollution between his ownership and your report.
I mean, we heard.
I mean, Alexandra Petri still has a job after a great satirical piece about this issue.
We heard actually that Bezos was, I don't know if this is true, this is hearsay, but we heard that Bezos was very unhappy, and certainly Amazon was very unhappy about that story we did. They didn't want it to get out. I don't know what is going to happen, because Amazon is very quiet about this, and they've basically asked everybody who knows about it not to talk to the press. And it's gotten much worse for us since our story broke, in terms of anybody being willing to talk to us, which we deeply regret.
You actually cover the entire region. You've covered Metro. You have this fancy title at the Post. What is it, senior?
Inflated title of senior regional correspondent. All right.
Whomever, whether it goes to Crystal City or not, but if it does go to Crystal City, this is not a loss for White Flint or Maryland, or a loss for the district with its spaces. Everyone I've spoken to says that it will be an economic boon for the entire region. Do you agree with that political thought?
I agree with it mostly, but not entirely. I agree with it mostly in the following sense, that if anybody in the Washington area, and right now it looks like it'll be Crystal City, if anybody in the Washington area gets such a big prize as HQ2 or half of HQ2, that's going to dramatically improve the prestige and reputation of the Washington area as a whole, as a place that's attractive for high profile, high tech, cutting edge, future oriented, innovative businesses. And it will help. I think it could be the tipping point. Winning this could be the tipping point where we are no longer seen as a government town.
And maybe we'll get Metro fixed.
Well, hopefully.
Well, let's talk D.C. for a second, both of you, because in D.C., incumbents had a very good night, whether it was Mayor Bowser sailing to victory without a strong opponent, or at-large council member Alyssa Silverman winning re-election after being challenged by someone the mayor supported, businesswoman Dion Reeder. Is this a sign that voters in Washington are happy with their leadership, or is something else happening here?
People are. I think the mayor's own polling and her own polling shows that people are happy in the city. She has a high rate of like 70% that the Post poll showed and acceptability. Things are going well in terms of the economics. There's a rise in the homicide rate this year, which is worrying many people, including the mayor. But overall, the city is doing quite well. You know, 20 years ago, financially, it was a ruin. It was virtually bankrupt. The city now has balanced budgets for more than 20 years in a row. It's growing. There are jobs. It's participating. The job growth in the district in Virginia exceeds the job growth in Maryland. So I think people overall are pretty happy all the serious issues that every urban area has.
But Robert, Mayor Bowser inserted herself into the at-large race, endorsing Dion Reeder in her bid to oust Alyssa Silverman, and then Silverman turns around and wins handily. What kind of position does that now leave the mayor in working with the council?
Well, I think, first of all, this is a significant embarrassment for the mayor. I agree with Tom completely that overall people are happy with what's happening in Washington. They're concerned about the homicide rate, but they're very happy with the economy overall. It's still not improving the lives of a lot of people in the poorest neighborhoods, but overall things are going in the right direction, and people overall are satisfied with Muriel Bowser. But she put a lot of effort into trying to trying to oust a sitting council member. And it just seemed as though she didn't like the fact that the council member was aggressively questioning her people in the executive branch, and trying to hold them accountable and trying to make sure that the money was being spent wisely, and wasn't kowtowing to her. And she basically ended up supporting this candidate making sure she got a lot of money and basically bringing her out of nowhere. This is Dion Reeder I'm talking about. And I think a lot of people were and the campaign ended up being kind of ugly. There was a lot of unpleasant racial rhetoric, unpleasant racial tone about the campaign. And I think a lot of people in the district were very disappointed in Mayor Bowser. And I think it will hurt a little bit her relations with the council, because it shows to some extent that she can't push them around. And I think they will be emboldened to some extent to stand up to her.
Very quickly, there are 13 members of the council. There's only one of them, Brandon Todd, who succeeded her at Ward 4, who is seen as her ally all the time.
Before you go, Robert McCartney, let's briefly talk about Governor Hogan. He became the first Republican governor to win re-election in Maryland in over 60 years, and he did relatively well in Democratic strongholds like Baltimore City, Prince George's County, Montgomery County. Presumably, there were a lot of Democrats there who voted for him. What's the nature of his crossover appeal?
Well, I think he's governed mostly from the center, and that's partly because he's got a very strong Democratic, he's facing very strong Democratic majorities in the General Assembly, so he sort of has to govern from the center, but he doesn't pick fights with them. He sort of goes along with them. He's a very adept politician. He's an authentic guy. He comes across as very likable and affable, and he, you know, there was a string there of they had the Democratic governors, two terms, Democratic Governor Martin O'Malley. He wanted to increase spending in a lot of ways. He raised a bunch of taxes. People didn't like that. Hogan is basically a bulwark against raising taxes. He's benefiting, obviously, from a very strong economy, a national economy. Maryland isn't doing as well as other states under Governor Hogan, but all states are doing better under this economy. And he has kept his distance from Donald Trump the way the Republicans,
maybe his major accomplishment,
Republicans in Virginia didn't. And look at the results. A lot of people were pretty happy with him. And the Democratic candidate, Ben Jealous, was pretty much of a newcomer, had no experience in government directly, and was pretty easily caricatured, I would say, as sort of being in, you know, very far to the left. And people just didn't buy that.
Malia Cromer, the Goucher College poster, said it best, I think. She said, it's hard to run as a change agent when people are satisfied. And Ben Jealous was simply just not that well known in the state to carry the progressive campaign he did. There are lots of people who like $15 minimum wage, Medicare for all, and other kinds of issues, but he could not carry it because he was not that well known in the state.
Well, I think one thing that was very interesting about this race is Jealous's people said from the beginning that their strategy was to have a really big turnout and get a lot of Democratic voters out there, because the party registration is more than 2-1 for the Democrats. And they just assumed if they could get a big turnout and a big Democratic wave that they would then win because he's the Democrat. But it didn't work at all. They did get the huge turnout. They did get the Democratic wave. But a lot of those Democrats, estimates are about a third, voted for Hogan instead of Jealous.
Robert McCartney, senior regional correspondent and associate editor with The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
Senior regional correspondent. My pleasure. I want to be called the senior political analyst.
Next up is Mark Eldridge. That's not going to happen. Mark Eldridge is up next. He's the Montgomery County executive elect. I want to talk about the D.C. State Board of Education races, Tom Sherwood, or do you want to talk about the ANC races in the district in which the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee managed to win 4 seats at the ANC level, at the most grassroots level of politics in the city?
Well, we knock off both of these fairly quickly. The ANCs are important as the most core group of elected officials in the city, because they deal with neighborhood concerns. About every 2,000 residents has an ANC commissioner who can speak on your behalf for all kinds of issues. But citywide, they're almost by law there. In fact, they can't band together to do citywide things. In the State Board of Education, there was very expensive money spread around, but the State Board members, ever since Adrian Fenty won the right to control the schools and select the chancellor, the State Board has very little advisory policy and influence. And so these races were not a major deal on Election Day in the District of Columbia. But maybe there are some people here now, and these will be the grassroots and the farm team of people who will get some government experience and run for higher offices. That's probably where it works most.
Joining us in studio is Mark Elrich, Montgomery County Executive-Elect. He's currently a member of the Montgomery County Council. Mark Elrich, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations to you.
Thank you.
You're still not wearing a tie. You're, you know, if you're going to be the county executive, someone was telling me you're going to have to up your sartorial excellence.
For those occasions, I will. You're not wearing a tie.
I hadn't noticed that. As a matter
of fact. Noticed it. I've a couple of people have. But congratulations to you. Welcome. Thanks for coming on the show today.
In terms of how you will govern, a piece in the Washington Post yesterday by Jennifer Barrios says, now Elrich must repair relations with the business community as he prepares to govern the county of 1 million people. To me, that report implies that you have a broken relationship with the business community.
And no cursing on the show when you get to this.
Do you?
How come the business community doesn't have to repair its relations with you?
That was my thinking when I first read the piece.
That's a fair question. I mean, I did get like about two-thirds of the vote and won by multiples of the nearest rival. So suddenly my problem is, do I repair this relationship? But I say the first thing is I'm not sure that my relationship with the business community in general is as difficult. My experience is that people didn't think, or at least the business community's issues with Montgomery County in general. You know, no place did I ever go where somebody said, you, Mark, have caused this bad business climate. They basically say Montgomery County is the most difficult place to do business in, and we're really upset with that. And I've heard enough anecdotal stuff, and intensely so, to believe there are things we need to fix. And I'm determined to fix them because they're not expensive. A lot of it is just how you treat people. Other of it is how you've organized your work processes in the county. I'm happy to do that. But I kind of put the developers couldn't say, Mark's going to make us pay more, vote against them. So they had to turn it into this bigger thing.
Let's talk about the policy. You did win big. You won in all five districts in the county. You know, Cojo and I did a forum on October the 1st, I believe it was. And I've since then, and just since the election, I've been shown the Mason-Dixon poll that you had back on September 28th or 29th that showed that you were way ahead of Nancy Florin, that while all the media, everyone, including me, were saying, well, Nancy Florin's going to split the vote with you and maybe Robin Ficker, the Republican, would win, or it's going to be tough because the business community poured $800,000 into our campaign. That poll then showed that you were well ahead, and that you were likely going to win. How did that affect your last month of campaigning? You allowed that. You never leaked that poll.
It wasn't my poll.
It wasn't your poll?
No, the poll was done
for Mason-Dixon did the poll.
Right. Not my poll.
Who paid for the poll?
I guess, for the groups that were running the independent expenditures. I never saw the poll.
You did not know about that poll?
No,
at the time?
So my assumptions were that the race would be closer, and B, that I had to work like hell, which I did. I mean, if you look at my schedule and what I was doing, you would not get the impression that I was on cruise control.
Well, that's what I was thinking. But anyway, the poll shows that you were well ahead the entire time. What you did so well, your candidate for governor, Ben Jealous, did not. Cojo just brought him up. Larry Hogan got something like 45% of the vote in your county. Will you be able to, what does that say to you in terms of working with Governor Hogan?
Look, I'll work with Hogan fine. I've worked with his departments before. I brought two housing programs down from the state. I've worked well with State Highway and with their DOT people. I think all of us know that in politics and elections, you exacerbate or you accentuate your differences. But at the end of the day, when you're governing, you have to get things done. And Montgomery County is important to the state of Maryland. It'll be important to the things that, you know, the Governor Hogan wants to do. And what Governor Hogan does and what the state legislature does is going to be important to what I want to do.
We got an email from Greg who says, as a Montgomery County resident and economic development watchdog, I'd like to know, will Eldridge, as executive, disclose Montgomery County's first-round bid for Amazon HQ2? Toronto did it. It's been downloaded more than 17,000 times and has become hugely successful as a tool for recruiting other tech employees or employers. That first-round bid is apparently not covered by a non-disclosure agreement. You can ask Amazon, apparently, to waive the non-disclosure agreement that does still cover the second-round bid.
Look, I'd be happy to have it disclosed, but I don't have it. I'm not county executive for another month, and I think the deal will be done before I'm county executive, so I don't think it's going to have much relevance. But if, as a historical document, I don't have any problem with people seeing what was put out there.
Go ahead.
You take office on December 3rd, is
right.
That correct?
Yeah.
That's when we'll see that tie show up. Now, one thing is that the
Amazon... He only has one, you're saying? Is that what you're saying?
There'll be one tie.
I have several suits, multiple jackets.
I'm going to come on December 3rd just to see. All right. One thing is the Amazon site in Montgomery County, the well-known secret is in White Flint area. In terms of development and working with developers and making sure that developers share in their infrastructure costs, for schools and roads and whatever, that White Flint area is ripe for development. The Lerner family owns that, I think most of it, if not all of it. I'm sure they're anxious to get something done. They put another site up for sale where the FBI building was going to go in Prince George's. But this is very critical for Montgomery County's growth to clear up that space around White Flint. What do you see as an incoming county executive there, assuming Amazon is not going to go there?
So... I guess I'm going to have to explain my views on development. I think that
many times
it would be nice if you could actually focus on a place, because so Bethesda is basically almost built out, and if you were being logical, you'd say, okay, so what's the next stop on the red line that's developable, and what's the place that has the most potential for development? I think it would make sense to try to focus development around building out White Flint. It doesn't make sense to me to scatter development everywhere. And White Flint is, you know, the logical next stop on the red line. And you've got now this totally vacated shopping center, except for Lord & Taylor, which is still humming along.
And only because of legal fights.
Only because of legal fights. The sad thing is that, you know, and the thing that interests me most about the Amazon deal is that we would have gotten enough money for transit to actually support the transit needs of White Flint. I don't know if the state's going to look at White Flint, and if I said I wanted to build the same number of square feet over the same number of years, which would generate the same amount of tax revenue, whether the state would put the same deal on the board to support the transit. And that's the unfortunate thing. I wish they would look at this and say, this could be an economic engine. It's a logical place to try to put development. It needs transit to make it successful, so the state's commitment is still to make it successful.
Here's Mark in Rockville. Mark, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Eldridge, traffic's a big problem in the area, and telecommuting is a good way to address that. It's good for the environment. A lot of private industry does it to improve things for their employees and improve productivity. County employees' access to telecommuting has been extremely limited. As county executive, would you promote expanding that?
Well, first thing I'll do is find out how limited it is, and then I'll see what people think are the impediments. I happen to like telecommuting. I think we all know that if it's significant people actually telecommuted, that you wouldn't have the traffic problems we have. I will say that from a real estate perspective, I'm not sure people are fond of that idea, because that would mean that businesses would require less square footage to lease, and that would increase vacancies. So I think some people would look at it as a negative impact, and I think other people would rightly look at it as a positive impact.
We just talked to Jennifer Wexton about the impact of women in the campaign there in Virginia, and nationwide, a significant number of women ran and won. But in Montgomery County, the council results is that Nancy Navarro will be the only female council member. This seems to be an outlier in the move towards having more women involved. Will you be sensitive to that when you're appointing people to government jobs in Montgomery County?
I'm sensitive to it, and I think
you were that, anyway. I think, but I just want to hear.
Yeah, I mean, the frustrating thing is you've got this. You can say institutional sexism and institutional racism, which after years and years of basically limiting access of women and minorities to positions where they would rise through and achieve, you know, grow up in the ranks and add to their skills. What you find is that the barriers that are in place there limit the number of people who are in, you know, higher level positions. And it's frustrating. And it's, you know, it's something that's going to take this country a while to get out of. And it's going to require a concerted effort to make sure that as you grow your workforce, you're putting people in positions where they can grow and rise to the top level of organizations.
Do you have a lot of positions to appoint? I mean, is it a dozen, two dozen, three? Or do you even know?
So I've looked at a list, and I think theoretically it's a little over three dozen, which is not a lot of positions. Right. You know, a lot of them are department heads, so you're talking about people who are, you know, highly skilled in specific areas. It's not a fertile ground for just appointing people who have been campaign supporters, which I think should give everybody a sense of relief. So we're really looking for, you know, the most skilled people we can find, but also trying to build as diverse a workforce as we can build.
Here's a question that you probably heard a lot during the campaign, and you'll probably be hearing a lot more during your tenure. It comes from Adam in Boyds, Maryland. Adam, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Kojo, and congratulations, Mark. I met you at the Poolsville Town Hall, the forum with the lawyer Nancy Florine and the Norman Thomas of the
right wing. He remembers you clearly, Adam. Go ahead.
What are you going to do now that you're about to take office for the Western Upper Montgomery County area? Poolsville, Boyds, where I live, Bellsville, Dickerson, and Barnesville.
So, one thing is, I think Poolsville has raised a really legitimate issue about the distances people up there have to travel to access services in Montgomery County. And I think there's a need for us to look at how do we extend services to those communities so that people aren't driving either to Gaithersburg or Germantown from the up county, particularly given the fact that you have now and always will have a very limited road network. On the transportation front, I'm going to work with Hogan, at least regarding I-270, and I believe that, you know, we ought to be adding two reversible lanes. It's what the council originally proposed some years ago when, you know, Phil Andrews was on the council with me, and I think we need to provide some additional access on 270. I know the state's looking at some creative ways of doing that and that don't nearly cost as much money as people anticipated, and they're hopeful that they can actually pull this off.
You just yesterday put out a notice you were doing a listening tour around the county. You're going to be going starting on Thursday, November the 15th in Potomac, then Saturday the 17th in Germantown, Thursday the 29th in Olney, and Saturday December the 1st in Tacoma Park, where you're from. So that's just a couple of days before you take office. So,
yep.
But is that an example of how you intend to be out into the entire county, the north up county areas, where Robin Ficker complained that when he was running that he's from Boyds and that the county just ignores that part of the county?
Well,
the
I've
county
always
establishment does.
Look, I always knew I was an at-large council member, and I've always tried to, you know, be in the northern and western parts of the county and meet with people up there, and we're going to continue to do that. We may actually, I think, be adding a fifth stop in the listening tour. We want to be sure that people have a chance to actually talk to us, not just vote for us, but to actually say what they think and, you know, put, you know, flesh on the bones.
Maybe satellite offices for some of the county offices?
Well, you know, we've got offices right now as far north as, you know, with the stuff we have in Germantown and Gaithersburg. We need to plant some stuff farther up county so people can go there for services.
And closer to your neighborhood, here is Ken in Rockville, but he wants to know about, well, Ken, tell him about what you want to know about.
Yes, yeah, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask regarding Silver Spring, with Discover leaving, that was the probably main driving force for the revitalization of Silver Spring. And with that leaving and Amazon not coming in, I'm wondering what plans you might have for that area.
Well, Discovery's been bought by another very large property owner, actually two people. And I'm assuming that they bought it because they think that it was worth making some purchase north of $70 million because they would be able to tenant the building. And so I'm hopeful that there are opportunities either in federal government repositioning or elsewhere to provide it to find a tenant for Discovery. It's an unusual building because it was purpose-built for one tenant, so it doesn't lend itself into a typical office building where you can carve off 2,000 or 5,000 square foot suites. So hopefully we're going to be able to find a quality large tenant that's going to be interested in that space.
Only got about a minute left, Tom.
At the Montgomery Cable Forum on October the 1st with Kojo, you talked about how you would look at reorganizing the county government. You think that it needs to be, I guess, brought into the 21st century or something. There'll be union issues. There'll be service issues. How quickly will you address us? No, we don't have time to talk about it. Yeah. But what's the timetable for you to reorganize the county government?
So we're going to start looking at this pretty much immediately. We are not going to have the revenues to continue to expand or, you know, grow just by what's coming in externally. So if we don't look at how we're spending our money better, and if we want to do new things, we're going to need to figure out how do we make better use of the dollars we always have. I've, you know, tried to tell people that if the answer to everything was taxes, you never have to be reflective. And the fact that taxes aren't on the table and there's not a lot of new revenue on the table, we're going to have to become reflective about how we operate and run the county government. And if we want to do stuff, we're going to have to find out how to do a better job with the dollars we already have.
And I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Mark Elrich is the Montgomery County Executive-Elect. He's currently a member of the Montgomery County Council. Once again, congratulations and good luck to you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show today. Never miss any of our shows. Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And meet us back here on Monday. We'll be talking about boys and ballet. Even though the Washington region is home to many well-known ballet companies and schools, many still believe that ballet is not for boys or men. And younger boys interested in ballet are often bullied. We'll explore how local ballet enthusiasts are encouraging more boys to give ballet a try. Matter of fact, I think Tom Sherwood and I make it.
You know, just try doing ballet if you want to see how strenuous it is.
It's very strenuous. A lot of football players do it because it improves how they can perform. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Kojo Nand.
The Kojo Namdi Show is produced by Ruth Tam, Mark Gunnery, Julie Deppenbrock, Margaret Barthel, and Lauren Marco. Our managing producer is Ingelisa Strobsdorf. Our intern is Talia Drayton. Our engineer is Josephine Neonai. For past shows and more content, go to kojoshow.org.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.